We are back. It is 2022. If you've forgotten who we are, who could blame you? It's been a while. This is The Europeans. It is a podcast about politics and culture around the continent. But you don't have to live here to listen. You can think of this podcast as a kind of weekly visit to Europe for your ears, especially at a time when traveling is still quite hard. My name is Katie Lee. I am a journalist based in Paris, and I'm joined, as ever, by my charming opera singing co-host, Herr Dominik Krämer.
Wow, what a lovely introduction. Thank you. Guten Tag, Katie.
Guten Tag. Your year's had an interesting start, I believe.
Yeah, you said that travel is still not very possible, but I am actually, for the first time in ages, traveling. I'm in the Austrian mountains.
Ooh, aren't you like singing on a motorway or something?
I'm not actually singing on a motorway, but I'm singing about a motorway and how a motorway about 50 years ago completely transformed this tiny, previously tiny village just south of Salzburg and turned it into a luxury ski resort, and what that means for the people who've lived here for a long time. It's quite an interesting project, actually, but very cold because we're doing it outside in a festival called Minus 20 Degrees, very appropriately.
Are you testing out the luxury ski resort?
No, I'm not going to be doing that. As long-time listeners might remember, I skied once and broke my shoulder on day two. So I'm not going to be doing that again. I did hike up the mountain the other day and then sled down, which was also terrifying.
Just as dangerous.
I know. I need to stop doing all winter sport, I think. It's not for me.
Stay off the mountain.
How are you, Katie? How's your holiday been?
Well, I quit my job to make this podcast.
Yay!
May or may not turn out to have been a great idea. But that is my cue to get in there with a early suggestion that you can support this fine podcast with a small monthly donation, because that is what is paying my gas bills. More on which later. But yeah, so far this year is shaping up pretty well. And I'm excited about bringing our listeners lots of new episodes from all corners of this amazing and complicated continent that we call home. Starting with this very episode, in fact, what are we talking about this week?
Well, if you live in Europe at the moment, you probably have noticed, like Katie and I have, that household energy bills have been rising massively over the past year. So we're going to be talking about why this is happening, what it means from a consumer perspective. We're going to be speaking to Marine Cornelis later on in the show. She is the director and founder of Next Energy Consumer and host of the podcast Energetic. Marine is a really charismatic talker, and you might think that talking about energy prices sounds really dry, but she does a really good job at making it interesting. So stay tuned for that coming up after Good Week, Bad Week. Good week, bad week. Who has had a bad week, Katie?
Well, I hear that things haven't been going great for a certain Serbian tennis player, but I feel like everyone spent quite enough time discussing that over the past week or so. So we are going to move on. And I thought it might be good to have a bit of a catch up on a story that's been kind of rumbling in the background since before we went on our break for the holidays, really. And that is the situation in Ukraine and the possibility that Russia might be about to invade its neighbor. It's quite an alarming situation, but a lot of the news coverage in recent days has been a bit impenetrable. Like, there's lots of talk about bilateral meetings, and I always find it quite hard to keep my eyes open when I hear that expression, even when the stakes are really high. So yeah, I'm going to try and bring you up to date on what's been happening in a non-jargony way.
I keep hearing and reading that there are like around 100,000 Russian troops on the border. Mm. Are they like all in one place? Are they spread out? Like, how imminent is an attack, do you think?
Yeah, so I don't know how familiar you are with the shape of Russia's border with Ukraine off the top of your head. It might be good to pull it up on Google Maps. But the Russian troops are currently sort of wrapped around the north, east and south of Ukraine. So the country is pretty hemmed in on one side. It's not like a wall of troops. From the intel that governments and analysts are putting out, they seem to be stationed in smaller but still pretty sizable groups in different places around those borders. So there's like 5,000 troops here, 10,000 troops there. And along with those troops, the Russian government has also been sending pretty serious military equipment. There have literally been Russians posting TikTok videos of like tanks moving through their towns towards the borders. At the time of recording, it doesn't seem like an attack is imminent, but they're certainly getting ready. They would need to have things like field hospitals in place if there was going to be a war like tomorrow. But apparently that kind of thing is pretty easy to set up and can be done quite quickly.
So this feels like a pretty big question, but why are Russia doing this?
That is a big question, and there isn't one definitive answer. Some people have suggested that this is Putin playing some kind of game with the West and trying to extract something that he wants from other governments. as a reward for not invading neighboring countries. Well done. Another theory is that he might be trying to distract voters at home from stuff that's been going on, like the certain matter of the pandemic, and that doing some macho chest beating always gets you a nice popularity bump. There's yet another theory that Putin is trying to figure out whether the US can generally be bothered to stop him doing whatever he wants to do right now. The US has the most powerful military in the world, but it just left Afghanistan and it doesn't really have much appetite for getting into another conflict. So it could be useful for Putin to test the waters and just work out, well, you know, like how outrageous can I be right now? Like what can I get away with? There might be elements of all of those things, but in the background, there is the fact that Putin has said, firstly, that he believes Russia and Ukraine are essentially one people. He's banged on about all of their shared cultural ties, their shared linguistic ties, which a lot of Ukrainians would argue are not as close as he says they are. But the bigger background issue really is this fundamental belief on Putin's part that Russia should have a quote-unquote sphere of influence, and that countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union should be within this area where Russia basically calls the shots. Now, one of the big obstacles to this wonderful vision of all Russia's neighbors basically being subservient to it is a little organization called NATO, a military alliance of 30 countries, mostly in Europe, but also including the US. And over the past few years, Putin has been increasingly bothered by NATO, mostly because it's been expanding into this supposed Russian sphere of influence. So countries like Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, all former Soviet countries, they joined NATO in 2004. NATO has also been doing more stuff in countries close to Russia, more military exercises, sending troops to be based there. And it's been doing this kind of performative show of force stuff because of aggressive behavior by Russia. You might remember that Russia invaded Crimea in 2014, this territory at the southern point of Ukraine. And Moscow just said, you know, well, this is Russia now, we've taken it over. And it's really hard to overstate just how much that rattled other countries in Eastern Europe. Countries like Latvia and Estonia started genuinely worrying that Russia might be eyeing them up next to take over a chunk of their territory.
And Ukraine, they want to join NATO, right?
Yeah, they do. And other NATO countries have publicly expressed support for Ukraine joining. It is kind of an open secret that it's not going to happen anytime soon, because everyone knows that it would make things with Russia even more incredibly tense than they are already, and it just doesn't feel worth it. Putin really does see NATO as an existential threat to Russia. And it's not actually crazy that he sees things that way. I mean, NATO was literally set up back in the 40s to try to stop the Soviet Union expanding. Its entire reason for being was to limit Moscow's influence. And even though the Cold War has been over now for decades, it feels, especially right now, like not much has changed. Moscow is still saying, this is our neighborhood. And Western countries are saying, well, countries in this neighborhood should be able to choose who they want to be friends with. That reminds me, actually, there's been a really interesting debate over the last few weeks about the language that gets used to describe these countries that Russia wants to be in its sphere of influence. You sometimes hear this expression, Russia's backyard, which I think some people have pointed out, rightly, I think, that it's kind of derogatory. It backs up this idea that Russia can do whatever it likes in this area. And on a similar linguistic note, there was this really startling moment on Twitter last week where the Russian embassy in London posted a tweet that described former Soviet territories as orphaned. And listen to the response that got from Polish MEP Radek Sikorski. He tweeted, get this, Russian embassy, once and for all, in the language you can grasp. We were not orphaned by you because you are not our daddy, more of a serial rapist.
Whoa.
Which is why you are not missed. And if you try it again, you will get a kick in the balls.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty astonishing. Anyway, I'm telling you all of this because this whole idea of Russia feeling like it is entitled to a quote-unquote sphere of influence, it's really key to this whole conflict, and it's key to why all of these troops are on the border with Ukraine. There have been a bunch of diplomatic meetings over the past week between Russia and Western governments in Geneva and Brussels and Vienna, and Russian officials have gone into those meetings saying, what we want is for you to assure us that Ukraine and other former Soviet states will never join NATO. To which the Western governments have replied, well, no, we can't promise you that because former Soviet countries should be allowed to do whatever they want.
So did all of these talks do anything to calm things down at all?
Not really, which is why I am unfortunately giving bad week to the diplomats. There have been a whole week of talks trying to calm things down. And at the end of those talks, Russia described them as a dead end.
So we are no less close to a war than we were before these talks?
No, it doesn't feel like it. And in the meantime, ordinary people in Kyiv and other Ukrainian cities and towns are talking about preparing to fight. And they're saying that they want to protect their homes from the invading troops. It's really, really frightening situation. At the time of recording, it doesn't feel like anything is changing immediately, but there is a lot of suspicion in the US government and other Western governments that Russia might be preparing what's known as a false flag attack, like a kind of faked attack on their interests that would justify an invasion. But the truth is that nobody really knows what's going to happen next.
Well, it must be pretty terrifying to be living in Ukraine right now or to have family there. And I mean, it sounds like it's been pretty scary for the last 8 or 9 years with over 10,000 Ukrainians dying in this conflict between the Ukrainian government and Russian-backed separatists.
Yeah, it's true. There's been this awful, awful conflict going on for the last 7 years, and it's just exhausting for everyone. I can't even imagine what it's like living through that. Cheer me up, please. Who's had a good week?
Okay, yeah, it's much like a good week. It's been a good week for American cheesemakers after an American federal judge ruled that anyone living anywhere can make cheese and sell it as Gruyere in America, even if they are making the cheese nowhere near the Swiss town of Gruyere, much to the disappointment of the French and Swiss cheesemakers who had brought this case to the US court themselves to try and better regulate what could or could not be sold as Gruyere in American shops.
I love this story so much. So is Gruyere one of those products that, you know, like there's some sort of protection regulation, so it has to be from that place, a bit like Parma ham has to be from Parma?
Yes, Gruyere is one of those foods that has this protected status in Europe to protect regional speciality foods and drinks and ensure that local communities are able to continue making their authentic products without someone somewhere else stealing their idea and sometimes undercutting them or not making it in the traditional way or the right ingredients. In Gruyere's case, it has this appellation d'origine contrôlée, which is the Swiss version of that EU protection of designation of origin status mouthful.
Yummy.
And also Gruyere of French origin is protected, but that must always be sold in the EU as French Gruyere to distinguish itself from the Swiss type, which is the real stuff.
From the actual town of Gruyère.
Well, yeah, although in Switzerland, the cheese doesn't have to be made in the actual town of Gruyère. It can be made in the surrounding regions as well. So it's not like so specific. Mm-hmm. Both of these designations, the French and the Swiss one, are respected across the EU, but now definitely not in America. So yeah, a consortium of European cheesemakers wanted this regional protection of origin to be in place in the US, but the judge ruled that it can now be sold in the States as a generic trademark. So anyone can make Gruyere. It's just a generic yellow cheese.
That is outrageous. What a lawless country America is.
Are you upset about it? Are you a fan of Gruyere?
I quite like a Gruyere, yeah. I mean, obviously I apply for French nationality because I like all of the cheeses, but I do quite like a nutty little Gruyere, yeah.
Mmm, tasty.
So what actually makes a Gruyere a Gruyere? What a profound question.
Well, there, with this like protected designation of origin statuses, you actually like have a list of what makes a cheese or a specific food their food. And one of the most distinctive things that's listed for Gruyere is that it has to be made in a climate close to that of a natural cave with humidity between 94 and 98% so that the cheese doesn't dry out, and yet it's not so humid that the cheese would become gluey. The humidity is really vital in creating this slightly damp texture that isn't very crumbly. Two characteristics that make Gruyere Gruyere. And in Europe, at least, along with that, the Gruyere has to be made in the shape of a wheel, and it has to have fruity notes to it as well. So these are characteristics that have made this cheese distinctive since it was actually first made in Switzerland in the 12th century.
In a natural cave, probably.
Probably. I haven't fact-checked that, but it's probably the case. The Swiss and French Gruyere makers believe that the cheese is anything but generic. One of the Swiss Gruyere representatives said to the New York Times that with this decision from the US judge, you can make a little cheese, a big cheese, a hard cheese, a processed cheese, and you can give the name Gruyere for all these types of cheese. And I do get that frustration for people who spend their lives making this very specific cheese that you can now package up a block of yellow cheese and claim it's Gruyere.
But this is good week, right? Like some people are doing well out of this decision.
Yes. And one of the directors of the American Milk Producers Federation also spoke to the New York Times and was absolutely ecstatic. He sees this as a repudiation of the European practice of, quote, confiscating all these names.
He
sees these protection of origin statuses just as a set of rules that benefit European producers at the expense of producers anywhere else. And yeah, he's not the only one that sees it like that. It's sometimes referred to as gastro-nationalism. I think we should do a whole mini-series on gastro-nationalism.
Yes, please.
And I said that it's a good week for American cheese makers, and there is apparently a lot of Gruyere-like cheese produced in Wisconsin, apparently. But the benefits of this ruling will also be in Europe. There might be a lot of Dutch and German cheesemakers who are pleased with this ruling because apparently over the past 10 years, the US has imported more cheese called Gruyere from the Netherlands and Germany than they have from France and Switzerland.
Really?
Yeah. I find that really interesting and a bit naughty of the Dutch and German cheesemakers because they're not allowed to sell the cheese in Europe and call it Gruyere, but they just like make it and then export it.
To foolish Americans who should know better.
Exactly. And it feels particularly irksome, I imagine, for the Swiss and French cheesemakers, considering the fact that the Netherlands benefits from quite a few of these protected designation of origin statuses for cheeses like Edam and Gouda.
They should fight back by making their own fake Gouda. Fouda.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that is happening already. I don't know.
So what were the judges' arguments for ruling that Gruyere is actually a generic kind of cheese?
Well, the judge's key argument was that people in America just don't associate this cheese with a specific region, which may be true. I don't know. But the ruling is therefore in contrast to similar American court cases for cognac and Roquefort cheese, for example, where American judges did allow trademark protections to come into force. This European Gruyere consortium, who brought the case to America, have said that they're going to appeal the ruling, so they haven't lost hope yet. But good week for American cheesemakers and some Dutch and German ones. But watch out, American listeners. If you're buying something called Gruyere in your shops, it might not have anything much to do with this nutty Alpine cheese. Oh, and before I stop talking about cheese, Therese Raphael pointed out on Twitter that NBC News, in their online article about this court ruling, illustrated the article with a photo of Emmental, which is truly a slap in the face for the Swiss and French makers of Gruyere.
Now they're just trolling us. Much like a small artisan cheese producer, the Europeans is a small and proudly independent purveyor of podcasts, which means that we would love it if you would consider helping us out with a small monthly donation via Patreon so that we can stay in business. Loads of you were super, super generous over the holidays and signed up to do this. Who are these lovely people, Dominic?
Big thanks to Rumple Bumpy, Rachel Lee, Simon Fox, Brent Simino and Brandon Caudry, Martin Cox, Emily Best, Mirella Petre and Emma Pearson. You can join them and receive one of the Patreon rewards we offer, such as a personalized voicemail from Katie and me, a postcard from us, or even a Europeans tote bag. Head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Thank you so much.
As you will definitely have noticed if you pay your energy bills on this continent, we are in the grip of a rather grim energy crisis and a gas crisis in particular. How's your bill, Dominic?
It's okay because I got a fixed contract just before they started shooting up. Although it's also, I don't really understand my energy bill. So maybe it's gone up and I just, yeah, I don't know. How's yours?
Mine's actually been kind of okay. I mean, my ancient Parisian apartment leaks heat anyway, so it's always been extortionate. But actually, just this week, the French government brought in this new decision that they're going to cap the price rises, which is good news for people like me. Yeah, but to give you an idea of how things are looking around Europe, I was reading a piece in Politico that said German consumers' bills are expected to go up by 60% this year, whoa, 40% in Italy and 54% in Poland. It is punishing. And there are various things that governments and companies have been doing to try to limit the impact. Kosovo has put a temporary ban on crypto mining because it uses up such crazy amounts of electricity. And at the other end of the solution spectrum, one UK energy supplier has advised its customers that ginger can be very warming.
What?
It was just some like added helpful tips, I think it isn't their like official policy. Yeah, but the situation generally is grim, and we wanted to know a little bit more about why it's happening, which is why we gave Marine a call. Marine Cornelis, she is the founder of the Next Energy Consumer Consultancy. She's really, really knowledgeable about energy poverty, among other things. And we gave her a call in the beautiful city of Turin to ask what the hell is going on. We have received a ton of messages from our listeners in recent months talking about just how eye-wateringly expensive their energy bills have become lately. In a nutshell, why is this happening?
Basically, many, many things are getting wrong at once. It's the consequence of geopolitical issues. It's a consequence of long-term political decisions as well. It's a consequence of the weather. It's a consequence of COVID and the economic rebound. So we can really unfold this if that's what your listeners want to know. But they just have to brace. We all have to brace.
This is something that's driving up the cost of other things beyond energy, right? I guess because companies are also being hit, and those rising costs, they're passing those on to their customers in some cases.
Yeah, exactly. This morning, I was hearing that the price of pasta will increase in Italy, and that's not only due to the price of grain, which has increased, but it's also due to the electricity and energy paid by the manufacturer of pasta have to pay and really transpose the cost to the final consumers. Even if you yourself are making some efforts to try to consume less and to at least control your expenditures, etc., the prices in any case might increase because of the price of energy in general. We have to be extremely careful.
And are there any European countries where consumers are better protected, like by their government or by regulation, against price rises in energy and price rises in general?
Yeah, there are some really good initiatives in general. For instance, Italy has decided to limit the VAT on gas to 5%. In Ireland, you also have tax rebate on heat, electricity and broadband expenses. This is also to encourage people to work from home, because of course it's a parameter that since we are staying home, we consume more energy because we need the heat all day long or the electricity all day long. So governments are kind of aware that the rising energy prices are a social time bomb, and we might have even higher levels of energy poverty in the years to come because of those high energy prices.
You mentioned geopolitical reasons being like one factor behind the rising prices. We are very reliant on one country, Russia, for our gas supplies here in Europe. I think about a third of our gas comes from Russia, maybe a little bit more. Is there any suggestion that Moscow has been deliberately limiting our gas supplies for some kind of political reason, or is that nonsense?
Well, I'm not an expert on Russia decision. I'm definitely not a spy on Russia. I'm sorry. I would love to be in one of John le Carré's book or a James Bond. I don't want to be a James Bond girl. I just want to be James Bond. But unfortunately, I can't really comment on this. What I know is that some decisions have been made at a political level, and that indeed Gazprom is a very, very powerful company that is managed by Russia directly. And basically, some geopolitical decisions have been taken regarding some infrastructures to import the gas. So you may have heard about a pipeline called Nord Stream 2 that should supply Western Europe basically with Russian gas. But the discussion to really make this pipeline work are still ongoing. The US also wants to have their say. That's also where the Ukraine discussion is hitting too, because until recently, Ukraine was like a gas hub for Europe. So basically, there are those kind of decisions, and there are also some really purely economic decisions. For instance, we design European markets or gas markets in general in a way that we European thought that as the buyers, we would have the final say on the price, etc. But in the meantime, you have China, which is willing to pay more for the gas at the moment. So Russia is able to fulfill their long-time contracts, but for the short-term contracts called the spot market, they are not so interested in filling their contracts for Europe. So we are in this really tricky situation where I'm really happy that I'm not a diplomat or a spy at the moment.
You keep saying you're not a spy, Marine. Maybe a little bit too much.
No, maybe.
So given that the energy insecurity and these price rises are continent-wide, has the European Commission been doing anything to try to alleviate the problem of consumer energy price rises and energy poverty in particular?
Yeah, so the European Union is really on the forefront of this question, and it has been for many years now. Recently, already in October, it has published some guidelines on how to contain the cost of this gas increase, giving like a toolbox for member states to implement actions. But the thing is, the European Union can only suggest to set up some strategies towards households and small businesses, for instance. But the final decision is in the hands of the member states. So that's why it's kind of a long-term discussion. And right now we are still discussing some things that would be useful to contain the price in the long run. So yeah, the European Union is active, and maybe they were even more conscious and aware of the situation before it happens. But at the end of the day, it remains in the hands of the member states, yeah.
So it seems like it might be good in general to try and reduce our gas habit for cost reasons or political reasons. What about the environmental impact? Like, how bad for the planet is gas compared to other energy sources?
It's a little bit tricky. I don't know which parameter you want to take into account, because if it's the CO2 emission, for instance, per gas, it's way better than the one from coal. Coal is really at the end of the tunnel. Nuclear is a little bit better, but you have to take into account so many parameters. And that's why the discussion over what is sustainable and what is not is becoming political. And that's why the European Union and member states are discussing what kind of investments are green and what kind of options should we follow, etc. And it's quite controversial at the moment that they have decided to include gas as a transition energy and also nuclear as a kind of sustainable energy too. So it's kind of a political debate. Scientifically, solar and wind power and hydropower are much better, but every technology has their shortcomings. Even hydropower, if you build a dam, you may do some damages on the local fish, for instance. Something that people are not really aware of is that an enormous part of the gas we use in Europe is burned to produce electricity. So it's not only about electrifying the system and replacing your old-fashioned boiler with a new generation heat pump, but it's also knowing where your electricity comes from. When we have everything, let's say solar, hydropower, or coming from wind power, etc., and we have well-performing batteries as well, we can relax a little bit. But in the meantime, we really have to save the energy we consume and make sure that our houses are well insulated, that basically we put a lid on the pan when we cook, because it saves a lot of energy. And doing this kind of things, it seems a bit mundane when you think about it, but it's actually a way to save energy on a daily basis, and it's good for you, it's good for your wallet, and in any case, it's better for the planet.
You mentioned these new generation boilers or replacement boilers, heat pumps. My boiler recently broke down, and I thought, oh, this is a great time for me to get one of these new generation heat pumps. But it turns out that, at least in the Netherlands, they are still prohibitively expensive to get them installed and to buy them. And you can only really use them in houses that are incredibly well insulated, otherwise they just don't work. Is there any sign that gas alternatives for warming our houses are going to become affordable and available in Europe in the near future?
For the time being, governments and the European Union, for instance, are very aware that we need incentives for this kind of new systems and appliances, because it's really prohibitive on the user side or the consumer side. You may remember that 20 years ago, solar panels were super expensive, and now they are at IKEA. You can buy some. Of course, it works a lot with incentives and how fiscal incentives work and how tax rebates and really fiscal policies are implemented. But somehow, I think that if we take a combination of this and a combination of market opportunities and also just some kind of measures to as the European Union is planning to just stop the rebate on gas boilers and make sure that people pay for what is really the true cost. It means that in a few years' time, the option will be much cheaper. BEUC, the European Consumer Association, has published a report in November or December, and they assess that heat pumps are actually the best option for consumers already right now. But of course, you have to find the person to install it. You have to find the fiscal incentives. You have to think about how efficient is your home, etc., etc. So yeah, put together, it's really, really hard work.
If you fancy delving deeper into energy policy, look no further than Marine's very own podcast, Energetic, which features Marine and other super clever people explaining how we can transition the world to using more sustainable energy. Check it out. The link is in the show notes. Thank you so much to Marine for joining us, and also our listener, Anna Gumbel, EU climate journalist supreme, for suggesting that we speak to Marine in the first place. What have you been feeding your eyes and ears over the holidays?
Well, I feel a little bit guilty about quite how much TV I watched over the holidays. Although, yeah, I mean, who can blame me? There was a lockdown or a partial lockdown in the Netherlands. So what else is there to do than watch Netflix?
No judgment.
One of the things I whizzed through was this Swedish series on Netflix called Young Royals. It's a drama about a teenage Swedish prince, second in line to the throne, arriving at an exclusive boarding school and grappling with some complicated feelings around his sexuality. It's only 6 episodes, so it's not a huge undertaking, but I completely fell in love with this show. If you try it, I should warn you that the first episode feels a bit trashy and light, and I wasn't sure I needed to continue it, but it gets better and better. And I think part of it is that the acting is just so good and that they cast real teenagers in the teenage roles. For once, because I feel like everything else I see that's about teenagers, you see like a 25-year-old playing a 16-year-old, and it's never quite believable.
Yes.
This is a really believable series, and it's got some really touching romantic storylines. So I really recommend it. Go and watch Young Royals. I'm actually surprised it hasn't become more of an international hit already. Have you heard about it?
No, I hadn't. I'm going to go and check it out right now.
Do it. What else have you been enjoying?
Mostly Belgian pop music. Belgian pop is having a moment, and I am here to celebrate two acts in particular. Do you know Stromae?
Yes, I love Stromae.
He's cool. He's been around for a few years. He does kind of sort of dancey pop music. You might know him for his song Papa Ute, which is about his father's absence in his life. His dad was really sadly killed in the Rwandan genocide. But Stromae has been in the news this week because of a rather powerful way in which he unveiled his new single. He was giving an interview on TF1, the French TV station, and the interviewer asked him, "You sometimes talked in your songs about loneliness. Does your music help you to free yourself from that?" And he just launched into this new song. It's called L'Enfer, or Hell. And it is a pretty vulnerable song about his struggle with his mental health.
Beaucoup de solitude. Est-ce que la musique vous a aidé à vous en libérer?
Je suis pas tout seul à être tout seul. Ça fait déjà ça de moins dans la tête. Et si je comptais combien on est? Beaucoup.
It's a really arresting performance. Stromae like breaks the fourth wall. He looks into the camera. And he sings during a TV interview about having suicidal thoughts. Some people have brushed it aside as basically a kind of marketing ploy for his new song. And he is definitely an artist who knows how to market himself. But yeah, it's being seen as quite a big moment in French language TV in terms of opening up about such painful mental health topics.
That sounds really powerful. I want to watch it. Will you put a link in the show notes for me?
I will put a link in the show notes for you specifically, Dominic. The other Belgian artist I've been listening to a lot recently is Angèle. Do you know her?
I've heard of her, but I can't remember why.
She's done a song with Dua Lipa. Maybe you've heard that one.
Yeah. Big Dua Lipa fan.
Angèle is a favourite of our Brussels listeners because she wrote this very catchy song during lockdown called Bruxelles, je t'aime, about how much she missed her hometown. And yeah, again, Angèle has been around for a while, but there's actually a really nice film out about her on Netflix. It's a documentary about her rise to fame and, among other things, trying to come out to her grandma, which proved pretty difficult. And I think she comes across pretty thoughtfully in it. Anyway, as our former guest Diego Velasquez pointed out on Twitter, it's pretty cool that the two biggest names in Francophone pop music right now come from Belgium, which is a pretty small country. So yeah, I just wanted to celebrate that. And I will now go back to playing Stromae and Angèle on repeat.
We should get them both on the show.
Yes, please. I'm sure they've got nothing else to do.
There was quite a bit of happy news around this week in Europe. I actually had some options to choose from for once, even though it was the week of Blue Monday. But one story really jumped out at me, and that was a news report from northern Spain, where a hungry badger seems to have unearthed one of the largest collections of Roman coins in the region ever.
This fits so perfectly into the Dominic Venn diagram of stories that you love. It's got animals and it's got like a historical treasure find. It's a story with everything.
It's true. It's what this segment was created for. And I should point out that the coins were, of course, eventually discovered by some human archaeologists, and well done to them. They deserve some praise too.
Good job, humans.
But probably the only reason why they were able to find this trove was because a badger had seemingly dug a den in search for food, and it had found the coins and brought some of them to the entrance of the den. Probably eventually sadly realizing that they were not food and were useless for the badger.
Useless!
But they meant that the coins, which would otherwise have been hidden deep in the cave, were findable for the archaeologists, who then dug into the den and found this huge treasure trove, 209 pieces, coins dating from between the 3rd and 5th century.
Wow.
Some thought to have been forged in places as far away as Istanbul, which was then called Constantinople. So a very happy badger ending.
We will be back next week. And it feels good to say it. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter, no longer posting Merkel GIFs, sadly, because it is a new era, but still tweeting interesting things from around Europe. We're there at EuropeansPod or on Instagram at EuropeansPodcast.
Yeah, go tell your friends about us if you haven't already. So it sounds really needy, doesn't it? But yeah, apparently that's the vibe I'm playing in 2022.
Hashtag desperate.
Or write us a review on Apple Podcasts. That's really kind and makes our day when people do that, unless it's a bad one, in which case it can ruin my day, frankly. This show was edited by Katie Lee and Wojciech Alexiak. Katz Laszlo, our other producer, is off working on some very exciting narrative episodes. We are a part of the Are We Europe audio family. Go and check out the other audio offerings on their network, such as Europarama and Sarajevo Calling. There's a link in the show notes for that audio page.
See you next week, everyone. Be careful on that mountain, Dominic.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Cheers.